Good morning, everyone. Sabik here. Hopefully I said that correctly. It's good to see you all. And of course, I have to say the cliche, which should never ever be a cliche, which is I bring with you the love and greetings of my brethren and sisters at the Toronto East Ecclesia. Isn't it great how we can just rhyme that off? Hopefully it means something, though, right? Hopefully it, and I know it does. I know my brethren and sisters at the Toronto East group of Christadelphians, if you prefer that expression, definitely send their love if they know that I'm here. Some of them do. And I hope, with your permission, I can return your love back to them when I go back. So, great. Awesome. That's what we're going to talk about this morning anyways. On the top of He is Risen, it seems kind of like a cold title, but it's a really amazing part of our calling, of our worship, of who we are as people, that we believe in the resurrection of Jesus. Without that, of course, we are of all men most miserable, probably of all women most miserable too. So, we're going to look at that as long as the battery on my laptop lasts. No, probably a lot less time than that. So, we're here on what you could call the first day of the week to remember our risen Lord. And in fact, that's been going on for a long time, meeting together on the first day of the week to remember the risen Lord. And in fact, we're going to talk about the first time that happened, which was on the day of his resurrection, which was on the first day of the week. And that's in Luke 24. And we just read that. That was, by the way, Luke 24 is the New Testament reading from the Daily Planner put together by Brother Robert Roberts a long time ago. And if you haven't heard me say this, I'll just say it again. But I always exhort, almost always exhort from the daily readings. The odd exception is when I reuse an exhortation maybe a week later that was on the daily readings when I did it the first time. And the reason for that is not because I think that the daily reading planner is something really special or inspired or anything like that, just because it allows me to take an exhortation from something that I didn't decide on. It's so that I just don't get up here and soapbox with my own ideas all the time, basically. So if you follow the daily reading planner, then you're with me in the readings. If not, that doesn't matter. It's just a chapter from the Bible that you could read at any time. So so we're looking at Luke 24 this morning, and it says there in the first verse, "But on the first day of the week at early dawn, they went to the tomb, taking the spices they had prepared." And in the context, that's the women that were the followers of Christ, a few women. And so they came on the first day of the week to remember their risen Lord, not even knowing at that point that he was their risen Lord yet. But they still came. They actually came to anoint his body with spices that they had prepared. They expected him to be dead. You don't generally plan to anoint a body with spices when that body is no longer passed away. And they expected him to be in a tomb. The tomb was guarded and had a stone rolled across its mouth. So we're not exactly sure what their plan was. They were just hoping that things would work out. The guard would help them, let them in. Maybe they didn't even know about the guard. So we don't know what their plan was, but they went anyways. Maybe they didn't really know what they were going to do and just had faith that things would work out. And it took them a couple of days to get to that point, right? Because we know Jesus was dead for 3 days, and it wasn't until his resurrection that they got there to prepare his body for proper burial. So it took them some time to get there, but they came anyways. They did what they could. The women came. The women that were followers of Jesus came to the tomb. Where were the men? I mean, you would think that the women would probably want the men with them if they had to deal with a heavy stone and some guards, but where were the men? It was only the women that went to the tomb. The men were gone. We were told that they forsook him and fled. But the women didn't. Now, a couple of the men had stayed around a little bit longer. You might recall that Peter followed Jesus to his trial. So he stayed around long enough to deny Jesus 3 times and then fled. And John stayed even longer, and he stayed right through the crucifixion. But we don't know at what point he also left. But we do know that 2 men retrieved the body of Jesus from the cross and put him in the tomb. Their names were Nicodemus and Joseph of Arimathea, not two of his disciples, two other men that came and took care of that. The disciples were gone, and the women stayed. So we can ask ourselves, when we're reading Luke 24, what would have happened if the women had fled too? Who would have discovered the empty tomb? Who would have spoken to the angels and been told what to do next? Who would have gotten the disciples to come back? Would any of that happened? Or would that have been the end of it? No one cared. Well, thank goodness that the women did stick around and they did come to the tomb and they did meet the angels and they did find out about the risen Lord. What if they didn't? So we're forever indebted to these women and their faithfulness for having not forsaken Jesus and fled. So, picking up in Luke 24, verse 2, I'll just read the account there. They found the stone rolled away from the tomb, but when they went in, they did not find the body of the Lord Jesus. While they were perplexed about this, behold, two men stood by them in dazzling apparel. And as they were frightened and bowed their faces to the ground, the men said to them, "Why do you seek the living among the dead? He is not here, but has risen. Remember how he told you while he was still in Galilee that the Son of Man must be delivered into the hands of sinful men and be crucified and on the third day rise." And so that was the scene that greeted them at the tomb. Obviously not what they were expecting at all, even though they were reminded that they were told that he would rise again on the third day. But they were not expecting that. And they were told to get the disciples and Peter. It's actually recorded in Mark chapter 16. We're going to be jumping a little bit around between the different gospel records. We're going to hit all four of them at some point. It's really interesting that the entire message is spread across four gospels, and you really have to work to get all of the message from all of the gospels. So Mark 16, verse 7 puts it this way. The angel said, "But go tell his disciples and Peter, he is going ahead of you into Galilee. There you will see him, just as he told you." Sometimes we take one person out of a group when they're part of that group and say their name first. Like in musical acts, it's done all the time, right? Like Jimmy and the Crickets. I think that was the name of a band. You say the name of one person who's sort of the leader of the group, and then you say the name of the rest of the group. And, of course, the leader is part of the group. Huey Lewis and the News. There's lots of examples. But this is different. Imagine if we said the Crickets, and it was Buddy Holly, wasn't it, that was in the Crickets? I don't know. Anyway, the News and Huey Lewis would sound awfully strange to say, wouldn't it? We don't normally say it that way. But here it is, the disciples and Peter, as if Peter's tacked on afterwards for some reason. It's not Peter and the disciples, which would be kind of the way you would normally do that. So is it that Peter is no longer part of this group? No longer a disciple of Christ at this point? Well, what was the last thing we read about Peter? "I don't know him. I don't know this man. I don't know who you're talking about." He said that three times. So Peter was not a disciple at this point. Mark 10, verse 33 says, "But whoever denies me before men, I will also deny before my Father who is in heaven." That was the state of Peter at this point. He had denied Jesus three times. No longer a disciple. So we'll just read the account there. It's in Luke 22, starting in verse 54. "Then they seized him, Jesus, and led him away, bringing him into the high priest's house, and Peter was following at a distance. And when they had kindled a fire in the middle of the courtyard and sat down together, Peter sat down among them. Then a servant girl, seeing him as he sat in the light and looking closely at him, said, 'This man also was with him.' But he denied it, saying, 'Woman, I do not know him.' And a little later, someone else saw him and said, 'You are also one of them.' But Peter said, 'Man, I am not.' And after an interval of about an hour, still another insisted, saying, 'Certainly this man also was with him, for he too is a Galilean.' Peter said, 'Man, I do not know what you are talking about.' And immediately, while he was yet speaking, the rooster crowed." So the risen Jesus had a little bit of work to do before he was able to go to his Father. And so one of the things he did, he was traveling with some random people on the road to Emmaus. Also, not the disciples of Christ, not the 12 or the 11, just a couple of believers. At some level, they believed. And he's walking with them along the road. And in the conversation, without them having any idea who he was, he convinced them that Jesus was risen. And he taught them from Scripture about the resurrection of Christ. But I want to bring out one phrase from this account, Luke 24, verse 15. It says, while they were talking and discussing together, Jesus himself drew near and went with them. So pay attention to that expression, Jesus himself drew near. And didn't know who he was, but he approached them, he drew near to them, and he spent this time with them to make sure that they learned about his resurrection, which was a crucial thing for them to understand. And they were confused and perplexed by his message that a dead person could be brought back to life and continue his mission. And that's fair. I mean, if I told you that someone who you knew had passed away was actually still alive, you would probably laugh me out of the room, right? It's kind of a hard thing to believe, and you might actually think I was being rather obnoxious for suggesting that. That's kind of a rude thing to say, right? If you go to someone's funeral and you keep telling, no, they're not dead, then people would suggest counseling at that point, right? You need to get over this, they're gone. So when a person comes along, no, he's not dead, he's really alive. They're like, look, buddy, just get some help. You know, you're not dealing with this very well. So yeah, it's something that we just don't accept when people tries to tell us that a dead person is no longer dead. Interestingly, Paul has to deal with this when he's in Antioch with Barnabas, talking to the people there in Acts chapter 13. He's trying to convince them, this is years later, he's trying to convince these people that Jesus is not dead still. And he says in that chapter, in the context, in verse 30, he says, this is Acts 13, verse 30, but God raised him from the dead, Jesus, obviously, and for many days he appeared to those who had come up with him from Galilee to Jerusalem, who are now his witnesses to the people. So Paul's talking about exactly the context of Luke 24, Jesus appearing to people to convince them that he was alive. And at the end of that section, in verse 41, he quotes from Habakkuk 1, verse 5, Paul does, and he says, look, you scoffers, be astounded and perish, for I am doing a work in your days, a work that you will not believe, even if one tells it to you. Now, the context of Habakkuk 1, verse 5 is a little bit different, but Paul is taking that idea and applying it to the difficulty that it is to believe that someone who is dead is now alive again. So, that was Jesus working with these people on the road to Emmaus, still no disciples. So finally, at the end of Luke 24, he meets with the disciples. And again, he had to convince them that he was the risen Lord. He's standing there right in front of them, and they were still struggling with their belief that he was risen from the dead. And of course, we especially know of the story of Thomas, who wasn't with them the first time and had to be convinced by actually placing his fingers into the wounds. But what we really want to focus on is this work that Jesus had to do with Peter. Peter was in a bad situation at this point. He had stayed a little bit longer around Jesus, but it didn't work out very well for him. And he ended up denying Christ, as we mentioned, three times. And so Jesus had something that he wanted to do with Peter. He didn't have to. He just wanted to do that with Peter. He wanted to resolve this. So what was his last instruction that he gave to his disciples, the whole group of them, before he was crucified? Right, a new commandment I give unto you, that you love one another as I have loved you. That was the main message that he left with them. He repeated it several times. He mentioned the importance of loving God and your neighbor several times in his ministry. This was a major message from Christ, and it was the last instruction he handed out to his disciples in the upper room, his new commandment. And so, if he wants his disciples to love him as he has loved them, he needs to demonstrate his love to them. And that is exactly what he does with Peter. He didn't wait for Peter to come to him. We have absolutely no record anywhere in the post-resurrection period of Christ on earth of Peter coming up to Jesus and saying, "Jesus, I'm so sorry. I denied you three times, and please forgive me." There's absolutely no mention of that anywhere. Now, did it happen? There's a small chance that something like that took place, and it's not recorded, but you would imagine that something that important would be recorded. So I can't really definitively say it didn't happen, since it's not mentioned. That's arguing from absence, but it seems like pretty reasonable to expect that that did not take place. It was rather Jesus that had to go to Peter. So Jesus didn't wait for Peter to come to him. He went straight to Peter. So what was Peter thinking? How do we do that in our lives? When we've done something that awful, denying someone's very existence that was supposedly one of our closest friends, and in this case, our Lord and Savior, probably we haven't had too many experiences with that in terms of dealing with each other, obviously. But what are we thinking when we don't go to someone? Right? Oh, sorry, it doesn't matter. I'm good. We'll just let it slide. Jesus probably doesn't even remember that I did that. He probably didn't notice. Maybe doesn't care. Everything's fine. Like, he's still talking to me, so that's good. And let's not bring it up. Let's not open old wounds. We'll just let it slide, and hopefully there's no problem. Is that the kind of thinking process we go through when we're in that kind of a situation? Well, let's look at John 21 and see the process through which Jesus resolves this. We're going to get into a little bit Bible classy kind of detail here, so I hope you'll forgive me on that. There's lots of stuff that I'm not going to say, and I'd be happy to talk to anyone. I'm going to have a slightly different take on this than you might have heard before, so please bear with me. So the account, John 21, verse 15. When they had finished breakfast, Jesus said to Simon Peter, "Simon, son of John, do you love me more than these?" Why does he call him Simon? Simon, he doesn't even call him Simon Peter. That's only in the narrative. He just calls him Simon, son of John. He leaves out the Peter name, which was the name that Jesus gave to him. All right, well, the account of Jesus calling him Peter is in one of the accounts is in Matthew 16, when Jesus asks, "Who do men say that I am?" And Peter's the one that says, "Thou art the Christ, the Son of the living God," which is the opposite of denying him, right? The exact opposite statement. "I don't know who that is," versus, "I know who he is. He's the Christ, the Son of the living God." That's the opposite. That's where Peter had stood with Christ before he denied him. And so Jesus said, "Thou art Peter. And upon this rock," probably referring to himself, "I will build this church." Now here he is after his resurrection, when he really needs Peter to be the stone that's part of that building, that's on the foundation that he laid by being crucified and raised by his ministry. And now he's going to leave, and he's going to rely on his disciples to do exactly what he talked about in Matthew chapter 16, except the one disciple that he was relying on the most and said, "I don't know who that guy is," instead of saying, "Thou art the Christ, the Son of the living God." So it's over here, and it needs to be here. So Jesus has some work to do. He calls him Simon at this point. But there's more. Because something else happened in the garden. Remember, Jesus said, "Do you have any swords?" It's just probably one of the weirdest things Jesus said. People puzzle over that. Why did Jesus ask them if they had swords? And they said, "We have two." And Jesus said, "That's enough." It's like, okay, confusing passage. And then who had one of the swords? You know, it's funny. That's an easy question. Here's a hard question. Who had the other one? There were two. Where was the other one? We have no idea. Maybe they left it in the upper room. We don't know. We only know what happened to one of the swords, and we know that Peter had it. And how do we know that? It says in John 18, verse 10, "Then Simon Peter, having a sword, drew it and struck the high priest's servant and cut off his right ear." Now, normally, I can't stand this kind of thing. I find it so cringe when people do it in their talks. I'm like, "Oh, don't do that. That's cringy." But I'm going to do it. I'm going to do it full cringe. I hope you don't mind me using the word cringe. All right. "Simon Peter, having his sword, drew it and struck the high priest's servant and cut off his ear. The servant's name was Malchus." I'm giving you the John 18 version of this because it's the only one that gives us this much detail, which is weird. All right, so Simon randomly cuts off someone's ear. I'm sure he didn't go, "Which one of you is Malchus? I want you. I'm going to cut your ear off." I don't think he planned to cut his ear off. That's not normally what someone does with a sword. Hold still, right there, I got you, okay. Precision cut. It's probably not what he was doing. He was probably just swinging the thing wildly near his neck, hoping to cut his head off, and just got his ear, right? But why do we have all this detail? Exactly what his occupation was, who his boss was, what his name is, and what body part was injured. That's interesting. Until you put it all together, until you realize that the name Simon means hearing. That can't be a coincidence. That Simon cut off the ear of the servant of the high priest, Malchus. Malchus is Hebrew for king. Can you think of someone who fits the description of servant, high priest, and king? I can only think of one person that fits that description. That's Jesus. And Simon cut off the Simon from the Jesus. He cut himself off of Jesus with that sword. I'll leave that with you. Like I said, I can't normally stand when people do that, but this is kind of hard to deny that all of this is here. So he cuts himself off of Jesus. And what happens next? Okay, this is the weirdest part of this event, right? You can get that he goes crazy with a sword. He's a fisherman, not a sword wielder, so he cuts his ear. But then Jesus stops. I'm being arrested here for treason. I'm going to be crucified, but wait. Stop the script here. I got to fix this. And he heals the man's ear. Hardly a life-threatening injury. Certainly not what Jesus himself would be going through. Nothing compared to what Jesus himself would be going through soon. But he stops the whole process to heal this man's ear. What did they say to Jesus when he was on the cross? Right? They said, if you are the Son of God, heal yourself. Come down from the cross. Jesus said, no, I'm not doing that. But he stopped during his arrest to heal one of his assailants. Only Jesus. But not simply to heal the assailant. It was all part of this story of Simon cutting himself off from Jesus and Jesus stopping to restore the ear back to the servant high priest king. Amazing. And then he says, Simon, son of John, lovest thou me? Remember the ear you cut off? Son of John, do you love me? Amazing connection. I told you to love one another as I have loved you. Do you love me? And Peter's answer was, you know that I love you. All right, now here's where it gets Bible classy. There's two different Greek words for love in this passage. We've probably all heard this before. One word is agape, the other word is phileo. And we've probably all heard before because it's all over the internet, all over mainstream Christianity, thanks to a book by C.S. Lewis, that agape is a strong, self-sacrificial love, and phileo is a lesser love that just means brotherly love. And I think it's kind of sad that this idea is out there and spread throughout the Christian world. It's very popular in mainstream Christianity. And it's all over the internet, like I said. But there's two problems with that idea. One is that it's just not true. And the other one is that it ruins this whole exchange between Jesus and Peter. There's absolutely nothing inherent in the meaning of the Greek word agape which makes it a strong self-sacrificial love. It's not a meaning of the word. The concept of love being self-sacrificial is a teaching of Jesus. It is not inherent in a Greek word which preexisted Jesus by hundreds of years. Right? It has nothing to do with the Greek word. When Jesus says that no greater love hath man than this, but that a man lay down his life for his friends, he was teaching something new. He wasn't giving you a Greek definition of a word. In fact, he uses the word agape in that phrase. No greater agape hath a man than this, that he lay down his life for his friends. Therefore, the word agape encompasses any kind of love, not just self-sacrificial love, by the way Jesus uses it in that sentence. Right? You can't say, no greater Mazda hath any man than this than a Mazda. It makes no sense. No greater car hath any man than this than a Mazda. Not that Mazdas are that great. I just picked a random car for that. But you have to use a more general term before you can give a specific definition for it. The definition comes from Jesus, not from the Greek word. The Greek word just means love. And in fact, it's used in 2 Samuel 3, verse 1 in the Septuagint translation of the Old Testament. Does anyone know it? Sorry, not 3. 2 Samuel 13, verse 1. Does anyone know what that chapter's about? It says that Amnon loved his sister Tamar. And the Greek Septuagint uses the word agape for that love between a man and his half-sister. It ended up in Amnon's death. So I guess you could call it self-sacrificial, but I don't think that's what we mean by that. So self-sacrificial love is good love, but it's a teaching of Jesus. It's not something that derives from a Greek word that pre-existed Christianity. And agape is also the modern Greek word for love. If you get a modern Greek-English dictionary, you look up love, it says agape, and it just means love. No special meaning. The word phileo, by the way, is gone from Greek as meaning love. There's a word phile, which is the same Greek word, Greek root, and it means kiss. And it did in Scripture. When Judas kissed Jesus, it's phile is the Greek word. That's still in Greek, but the meaning love is gone from the word phileo. It's an archaic word. In fact, in Jesus' time, the word agape was the more modern word for love, and phileo was the old word. So phileo is used in compound words like Philadelphia, which is brotherly love, which is interesting because people usually define phileo as meaning brotherly love, yet Philadelphia is the word for brotherly love. So if phileo itself meant brotherly love, then Philadelphia would mean brotherly love, which doesn't make too much sense. So anyway, I don't want to get into too much detail, and I can talk at no end about this later if people are interested in more about this. But let's see how this affects this John 21 account between Jesus and Peter. Let's go with the traditional analysis of strong love, weak love, and this is how it goes. So Jesus says to Peter, "Do you agape me?" Or to use the traditional analysis, "Do you have strong love for me?" And Peter responds, "I have phileo love for you," or "I have weak brotherly love for you, but not strong sacrificial love for you." So Jesus says, "Do you have strong sacrificial love for me?" And Peter says, "I have brotherly love for you, that's all." And then Jesus says again, "Do you have strong sacrificial love for me?" And Peter says, "I only have weak brotherly love for you." And the third time, Jesus says, "Do you even have weak brotherly love for me?" And Peter says, "Yes." And he gets upset. "Of course I have brotherly love for you." That's awful. That's not a reconciliation. That's a disaster. That didn't work at all. Peter can barely love Jesus back in the way that Jesus loves him. And when Jesus even questions his weak love, Peter gets all upset. "Oh, yes, I have weak love for you." That's terrible. That's not a good reconciliation. And the other thing that's going on in the actual account is there's a change in the response of Jesus afterwards. The first time he says, "Feed my lambs." The second time he says, "Tend my sheep." And the third time he says, "Feed my sheep." So you can see that is also growing. Well, that one's growing. It would be nice if they were all growing and becoming stronger. So let's look at it a completely different way. So like I said, agape was the newer Greek word which was coming into vogue at the time, where phileo was the old Greek word that had been around and has eventually since then died out as meaning love in Greek. And the way that this happens all the time in language. One word comes in, another word goes out. So agape would have been very common in the educated elite in cities. And phileo would have been the older word, would have been used in more conservative outlying communities, rural communities, fishing communities, let's say. So agape would have been common among educated people in Jerusalem. Phileo would have been commonly used by fishermen from Galilee. So that would be the different usage you would get. And of course, we know from Acts chapter 2, when the disciples spoke to the crowd, they were immediately identified as being uneducated Galileans. How did the crowd know that? Well, the way we always know where someone is from when they start talking, right? People have accents, they have dialects. You can recognize when someone is from somewhere else. People who were Galilean had identifiable accents that everybody would have noticed when they spoke. It says in Acts 2, verse 7, "And they were amazed and astonished, saying, 'Are not all these who are speaking Galileans?' Well, they could tell from their accents that they were Galilean. Even though there was a miracle going on and they heard them speaking in different languages, they still identified them as Galileans by their accents. And we know, in fact, that people identify Galileans by their accent from what account? Oh, from Peter's denial of Jesus. It very clearly says there, it's in the Matthew record, Matthew 26:73. After a little while, the bystanders came up and said to Peter, "Certainly you too are one of them, for your accent betrays you." The people in Jerusalem recognized a Galilean speaking from a few little words that he said. I don't know the man. She could tell that he was Galilean. So now let's look at John 21 again. So it's Jesus says in his Jerusalem educated elite accent, "Do you love me?" Peter responds in his Galilean dialect, "Yes, I love you." Jesus repeats in his educated Jerusalem speech, "Peter, do you love me?" And, or "Simon, do you love me?" And Peter responds in his Galilean dialect, "You know I love you." The third time, Jesus speaks to Peter with his own Galilean accent that he would also have from being raised in Nazareth. And he says, "Simon, do you love me?" One Galilean to another. And then Peter remembers, right? We all know, we can put this together really easily. Three denials, three times Jesus asks Peter if he loves him. Peter knew he denied Jesus three times. Jesus told him he would deny him three times. But Peter didn't know until the third time Jesus asked him what he was doing. He couldn't predict there would be three. He didn't figure that out until there were three. Then he suddenly realized the third time when Jesus asked him what exactly he was doing. And Peter would have remembered that the woman said, "I know you're Galilean because your accent betrays you." And as soon as Jesus started speaking to Peter with a Galilean accent the third time, which was when the woman said that, Peter would have gone, "Oh, I know what's going on here." He would have figured it all out right then. And how would he have felt about that? Well, what happened the third time when he denied him? Jesus looked at him, and then he went outside, and he wept bitterly. The third time, when he remembered that that's what had happened, when it all came flooding into his brain right there in front of Jesus, he got upset. Right? That's the best way to get upset, is to remember a time before when you were upset. That's how actors do it, right? So he got upset, because now he knew exactly what Jesus was doing. Right? This wasn't a failed reconciliation. It was quite the opposite. Remember what we noticed about the road to Emmaus? Jesus himself drew near. Jesus went to them. Jesus approached them. Jesus doesn't stand to the side waiting for us to come to him. Jesus approaches us when we need him. Jesus wasn't moving further from Peter. Jesus was moving closer to Peter. Jesus wasn't trying to create a gulf between one kind of love and another. He was coming to Jesus as a fellow Galilean. A solidarity. Moving into a closeness with Peter. Bridging the gap that Peter himself was unable to bridge. He was coming to Peter's level. Gently, subtly reminding him of their connection, while also letting him remember himself exactly what he had done. There was no accusation. Jesus never says, "You denied me three times." He didn't need to. He just did enough to remind Peter of where he stood. The ear was healed and restored to the servant high priest king. And this applies to us in two different ways. We're constantly cutting our ear off of Jesus. And we always need to be restored. Every day, all the time. Every time we deny Jesus through our words, our actions, or our lack of actions. Every time we cut ourselves off from the servant high priest king, we need to be put back. And Jesus is more than willing to reach out to us and to bring us back to him, to draw near to us, if only we will let him. And so, well, the table is right here. It's here, and we just have to come to it. Jesus has already done everything necessary to provide this table for us, and we just have to come. So that's one thing that we need to do. But there are others out there who have also forsaken him and fled. There are others who have wronged us, that have cut themselves off from us in some way. And like Jesus did with Peter, we need to make that effort to draw near to them, to reach out to them and reconcile with them. So do we reach out? Do we ask them to love us? And do we reach out in a loving way, in terms that they can accept? Do we reach to them on their level? Or do we demand that they come to us on our terms, on our level? Do we feed Jesus' lambs? Do we tend Jesus' sheep? Do we feed Jesus' sheep? Or are we only here to feed ourselves? The bread and wine we take, and that's good enough. I have it. I'm safe. So as we, this morning, partake of the bread and wine, as we take what Jesus has offered to us freely, what Jesus has given to us, we can ask ourselves these questions. Do we love one another as Jesus loved us? Thank you.